This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are we doomed to climate hell? It often looks that way. So I was doubtful about a new book claiming humans could go back to a safe atmosphere. Author Peter Fiakowski knows climate despair, but he refuses to let us give up. His new book is Climate Restoration, the Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. Dr. Fiakowski trained at the famous Massachusetts Institute of Technology as both a physicist and engineer. He has worked with NASA and artificial intelligence, holds 27 patents, and advises clean tech companies. In 2017, Peter launched and led the Foundation for Climate Restoration. Now his new book tells us all how to do it. From Los Altos, California, Peter Fiakowski, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thank you so very much. It's a privilege to talk with you in the audience.
Well, despite the Paris Agreement and all sorts of green promises, the fossil fuel industry is booming. People think it's patriotic. It should. Greenhouse gas emissions set new records every year, and we have terrible climate-driven events. They're so common. Isn't climate despair the most rational assessment, Peter?
Climate despair is the rational assessment. And what my book points out is there's predictable, which is despair, absolutely. And then there's what we're going to do. And so we could take the car and turn the steering wheel to where we want to go. And well, I grew up on the East Coast, and when I learned to drive, my driver instructor said, listen, it's not snowing now, but when it snows and you get into a skid, and don't look at the tree you want to avoid. Don't look there. Look down the road where you want to go. And in climate, we've been looking at the tree, at the 2 degrees that we don't want to do, and we've been headed straight there, because the way the brain works is what you pay attention to is what you get. And so the book is about climate restoration, because what we really want is to leave future generations the climate that our species with our and our civilization grew up with. And so paying attention to it means that we actually can get there. And I think in the next few minutes, we'll talk about how.
We will indeed. But maybe climate despair is the biggest barrier to saving ourselves. It's almost like a kind of denial, even within the climate-aware community.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I guess it's a lesson that sort of leadership training often teaches, which is focus on what you really want. Figure out who it's for and what you want. And that, for me, in the climate restoration field, the breakthrough was I knew I didn't want climate disaster. And at the second or third climate conference I went to in Marrakech, a bishop invited me to dinner, and it was a beautiful dinner, lots of wine, thank God. And it took 2 glasses of wine before I realized that climate is not a science problem. Science is going to be fascinated by our changes, and it is. Climate is a problem for humanity. And I realized, the customer is humanity. And it took me almost no time to ask, well, what does humanity want? And as I said earlier, humanity wants to get the climate that we were designed for, that agriculture developed inside of for the first time in the history of our planet. It was a major insight, because I could see to reframe climate rather than being for business. You know, in Congress, a lot of the work on climate is how do you create jobs? How do you make profitable businesses? And that's a good thing, but that doesn't give you restoration. Restoration is about future generations. And so we have to refocus on identifying and being concerned about the concerns of future generations, which is a little difficult, but not too difficult.
So let's dare to dream that humans can repair the damage we have done, starting with the atmosphere. What is the target in general, Peter? Where do we need to go?
Well, CO2 levels in the atmosphere has been about 280 parts per million since the last ice age, since the end of the last ice age, so about 10,000 years. And that's where we want to get back. Scientifically, there's not much you can say about it, but just as a parent, you say, let's go back to the safe harbor. We use the term safe harbor is in stormy seas. The captain will look at his map and find the closest safe harbor and make a beeline to get there as quickly as possible. And that's what we want to do with the climate. So 280 is our safe harbor because we know we've been there and been safe.
Well, Dr. James Hansen and then 350.org suggest 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide is the upper mark for a safe climate, and we're now passing 420 parts per million and climbing ever faster. Some people think 350 is unrealistic, but now you say we need to go even lower to 280. That makes it even harder. Why set the target so low?
Well, it's sort of like, I was talking to someone today, and it's sort of like you can think that you want to have a date and you'll have a great evening, or you can actually tell someone, listen, I want to, pardon my French, I want to get laid tonight. And as you tell them, you're likely to have it happen. In the same way, once you say we really want a safe harbor climate, then you can find a way to do it. It's the difference between, I might think I want to have lunch with you tomorrow, but once I say, let's have lunch tomorrow at noon, halfway between wherever you are and I am, if we say it, then we actually buy the tickets and get there. And so asking for it is how we find the way to get there. But it's the difficult distinction for people. It's easy once you get it, but in science, it's all about predicting. So as a physicist, I predict what's going to happen. I was an astrophysicist originally, so predicting what was going to happen in distant galaxies, but also in a wide range of electronics and so on. You predict what's going to happen. In engineering, you actually cause what you want to happen, which is very different than predicting. So what we want to do is shift the idea of climate from simply predicting to causing, and so going from science to engineering.
Frankly, I presumed your book would duck the population problem. So many public figures do, but instead you devote a chapter to it. Can we set a goal, a real number, for the long-term survival of humans on this planet, or what do you come up with?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a very optimistic journey I've been on, because I started out in 1975 learning about global warming and thinking we have to get CO2 out of the air. And then in my work in the last 5 years, we have the ability to get all the CO2 out. We can duplicate what nature does. And once I realized that we could do it and the companies that are working on it were doing it, I realized, it's not going to make any difference if we have a population that's 10 times the sustainable level that we had during the last 10,000 years while we developed agriculture. And I was in despair for a while till I did the math, and as a physicist, I'm qualified to do nice math. And I did the math, and I said, well, using the safe harbor model, what human population we know is sustainable for thousands of years? And the last population we had that was sustained for thousands of years was about 2 billion. It's a bit more complicated, but I'll call it 2 billion for the moment. If you look it up, it's about 1 billion, but you can interpret it as 2. And then the question is, okay, good, if we wanted to get the population back to 2 billion, how would we do it? Well, the first thing we all think, I think we all had this horrible thought, well, we could have a nuclear war, that might, but of course it's very unlikely to get it from 8 billion to 2 billion. It'll go from 8 billion to 7 billion or 8 billion to 0 billion. And we don't, that's not good. That's no good. Well, how about a disease? It's the same problem. It's unlikely to get you where you want to go. And that leaves having small families for a certain number of years. And so then I said, great, let's do the math. What size family for how many years? And so as an engineer, I said, well, I like round numbers. Just like John Kennedy said, we're going to land a man on the moon by the end of the decade. Why? Because it's a round number. So I picked the end of the century. And so let's get to the population safe harbor by the end of the century. Well, how do we do that? It turns out that if we bring our birth rate down, it's now about 2.3 It's down from, it was 5.3 in 1960, and if we bring it down to, it went from 5.3 to 4.3, 3.3, it's now 2.3. If we go one more to 1.3, is what it is in Italy, for example, then by the end of the century, our planet would be back at a safe harbor population, nice and stable. It's like, we could do that. You know, we know how to, we've proven that we can take whole nations and give them the security they need and the confidence they need to have small families. So it's actually doable.
Do you think we need to give up some fossil-powered benefits like flying around for holidays, at least until sustainable solutions are found? And are we ready to tell people saving the climate will require sacrifices? Won't they just turn away then?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm a firm believer in play the card you're dealt. So to turn the card over, see what card really is, and then play it. And I don't think they're going to give up flying. And not only that, even if they did, how much difference would it make? So that's sort of the news and the bad news is we can dream that we could pressure people into stop flying. But the likelihood of that succeeding is low enough, you know, it's certainly less than 50%, that I'm not going to spend my time there. In contrast, it turns out one of the companies that I've been involved in a little bit converts waste to jet fuel. And it turns out that municipal waste from cities, you know, the garbage trucks that go down your street, they produce enough material that using technology that was developed in World War II, it's been refined, but it was developed then, it'll produce enough jet fuel from our municipal waste to run all of our airlines. And so we can, for a few more decades, run our airplanes off of the energy coming out of our city waste. And so it's not, we don't need to despair. And another thing I discuss briefly in the book is, you know, many of the listeners are familiar with, of course, nuclear power, and then people are talking about fusion power. There are a few of us working on cold fusion, which was said to be debunked by the physics field back in the 89-90 when it came out. But if you look at it, we've demonstrated it and testing it, and so it looks like that will probably come out in the next year or two. Hopefully there'll be some big news reports about that, or maybe we'll keep it more into quiet. My point there is we've got everything we need to restore the climate, to get CO2 back to pre-industrial, to get methane back to pre-industrial, to get our population back to pre-industrial, but keep our technological lives. And I invite you and your listeners to imagine, you know, towards the end of this century, where, you know, the population is much lower, and so you know, the traffic jams are less. The national parks, you know, are free and lush because they're not being encroached by people, by more billions. And just but imagine that future where the number of people in the country is low enough that everyone gets a good education. Everyone gets really good nutrition. You know, however we guarantee it, we guarantee it, whether it be government or faith-based or philanthropic or just everyone prosperous, whatever your favorite modality is. If you imagine it, it starts happening. If you get very specific, you're making, you know, I'm asking people to get very specific that we want our future generations to live in a healthy planet, and to make sure that kids are raised in a very healthy fashion so that they're well-adjusted.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Peter Fiakowski. We are talking about his new book, Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. It is time to get to the best tools to save ourselves. Your book, Climate Restoration, investigates the big four solutions. Would you like to take some time to introduce us to them?
Sure, sure. The first one is, how do we get rid of a trillion tons of CO2? And the answer is, the best thing to do is to do what nature does. you're probably familiar with the concept of ice ages. When the planet goes into an ice age, CO2 levels drop by the same amount that we've risen the CO2 levels in the last 100 years, which is about 130 parts per million. And so then you might ask, what does nature do with that carbon so that the planet cools? And nature puts the carbon in the ocean in the form of biocarbon. So you have plankton that grows, which is algae, and it feeds some fish, but in the end, the dead plants and the dead animals sink. And what's wonderful about this in the ocean is that it doesn't rot, because on land, when a tree dies, it rots or it burns. In the ocean, when things die, they sink, and there's not oxygen in the deep ocean for it to decay, and so it takes the carbon with it. So then the question is, okay, good, so you can, there's lots of sun in the ocean, lots of water, and there's nutrients in the water. So what does it take to actually get this to happen faster so that we can do CO2? And it was discovered 30 years ago that the critical nutrient in most of the ocean seems to be iron, and phenomenally small amounts of iron. It's about 1/4,000th as much iron as you put fertilizer on a cornfield. So it's about a kilogram per square kilometer, which is, if you've ever cleaned up dust off of your backyard, you realize that's way less than the dust that falls on your backyard or your back patio. So that's the first one. It was tested at scale 10 years ago in the Gulf of Alaska. And what's very nice about it is, and it worked. So they do it in an eddy, which is about 100 miles in diameter. And that keeps the nutrient, which is the iron dust, iron ore dust, contained, so that you get a healthy ecosystem in the eddy, and you keep the less healthy ecosystem that we're used to outside of it, but it keeps things stable. And then the fish come to eat the food, the algae. And on the one hand, you sequester, when they did it, they estimated about 82 million tons of CO2. And they use about 70 tons of iron dust, iron ore dust, so it's iron rock dust. And the exciting part is at the end, the next year, the algae that grew became food for fish, especially salmon. And the salmon harvest was 4.5 times what it had been the previous year. And 4.5 what they expected. I think it was like 8 times the previous year. I think they expected a small increase. And it was the biggest salmon harvest they ever had. You can look that up in the records of Alaska as well as the records of Canada. And it produced about $500 million of additional revenue related to that salmon harvest. And it only costs about $2.5 million to implement. So you have a phenomenally cost-effective way to do it, which the government did not have to fund. And so that's the number one pathway. In order to get all the CO2 removed by 2050, which is our target, all the excess CO2 that way, is about 500 of those eddies. And that, if you multiply it out, it comes out to about 1% of the area of the ocean. And that means that part of the ocean will be revitalized with a lot of fish growing, restoring fisheries. But most of the ocean will do its gradual improvement and worsening, just as it naturally does. But the point is, some people think that the iron fertilization involves the whole ocean. And indeed, that's crazy talk. If you do the math, realistically, it's just 1% of the ocean. And that's a little bit like farming 1% of land. In reality, on land, we farm about 40% of it. So it's relatively very safe.
Well, in October 2021, Stanford scientist and the chair of the Global Carbon Project, Rob Jackson, told Radio EcoShock listeners about the promise of methane removal. And methane is a short-lived gas in the atmosphere, even though it is powerful for warming. Is it still worth investing in technology to reduce it?
You know, the politics in that is very complicated. So technically speaking, just as a pure physicist, the answer is no. That is, of course, it's good to get rid of methane leaks, you know, leaky pipes and so on. In terms of improving the climate, the sources of methane are so dispersed around the climate, around the planet. So most of the methane comes out of wetlands. So, and then a lot of it comes out of rice fields. Like you have, when you have a rice field, you have all this rotting material under the water. And then, of course, you have a lot coming from coal mines, which are huge, and you can't put a piece of plastic over the big coal mine. And so really reducing methane emissions is difficult, if not impossible. And even if you did, it doesn't solve the big problem. And the big problem with methane is the risk of a methane burst. And it turns out that just like with CO2 removal, we use nature's methods. And for methane, nature naturally oxidizes methane in the atmosphere. So it lasts, on average, about 8 years in the air. And then just natural processes oxidize it into water and CO2. So we said, well, can we accelerate that? Can we double the rate of oxidation and get the half-life, as we call it, down to 4 years? And it looks like the answer is yes, and it looks like it's not very expensive. There's this technique called iron salt aerosol. It uses iron chloride, which is a natural chemical. It's just iron and chlorine, like in salt. So it's not particularly harmful. I mean, if you swallow it, it's an irritant. I've gotten some on my fingers, and it's like, oh, I can feel that. But you know, the iron itself, we all need iron, and we all need salt, like chlorine as in salt. So the iron chloride will oxidize, is activated by sunlight, and will oxidize the methane. And so we're currently working to develop the technique where we disperse the iron chloride vapor in ship exhaust in order to disperse it widely over the ocean. And all the evidence is that over the next 5 or 10 years, we can develop that to the point where we reduce methane levels back to what they were pre-industrial, which is great because it'll reduce global warming, if you know, assuming that we do that. And no one's seen any reason that I've been asking a lot of people, how could we fail? And we haven't come up with any good reasons other than we just got tired and decided to go to the movies instead. And we're not going to do that. As I said, it looks like it's safe. There's no indication. We've had initial environmental evaluations done which say it's safe. Assuming that we do it, then we can get global warming back to what it was in the year 2000 and do that well before the year 2030, which is phenomenal. And again, it starts with doing it as an engineer, saying, here's our goal, and then figuring out how do we achieve that goal, as opposed to we'll be using the science but not guided by the science. Science will guide you to having more of the same, which we don't want anymore. We want to go back. And so the engineering takes to what we want.
Radio EcoShock guest Dr. David Keith at Harvard leads a project for direct air carbon capture. Right from the air, his team has a former industrial plant in British Columbia working on it. But, Peter, why are you doubtful about direct air capture?
Direct air capture is very interesting. I've worked with David Keith on some of his projects there. The problem with it is for a project to be successful and make a difference in the climate, it needs to be scalable. And direct air capture is scalable. It needs to be permanent. And direct air capture can be permanent. If you find the right place to pump it underground, you can make it permanent. But the third one they fail at, and it has to be viable, which means say you have to have someone fund it. And direct air capture would require about $5 trillion a year of funding. And there's just not a funding source for that. Whereas if instead you do the iron fertilization, that would cost about $500 million. Less than a thousandth as much as the direct air capture, and it has its own funding source, which is the fisheries. So that's the issue with the direct air capture, is it's not viable. And it's also very expensive compared to using nature's method.
I was going to say, this all sounds like geoengineering, more technology to solve problems of technology, but you think it's more than that?
I call it terraforming. So what we're doing is we're terraforming the Earth to look like Earth again. There could be someone who opposes that, but most of us who have kids and grandkids really do want our planet to look like it, a planet that will allow humans to flourish. So the terminology is important. The UN IPCC recommends against using the term geoengineering because it is a very emotional term now. And so they recommend instead only discussing the specifics of carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management.
In the book, you say we need to remove 7 tons of CO2 per year for every man, woman, and child, the equivalent of 14 pounds a day. Can we do that?
Yeah, we certainly can. That's the great thing, is especially with the ocean fertilization. So the second thing I haven't discussed at length here, but synthetic limestone, we can definitely remove it at that rate. We could remove it faster if we wanted to. Over the next 5 or 10 years, we may discover that we want to move it to restore it faster than that. It's interesting. Once you set the goal and put smart people on it, they say, using nature's methods. The nice thing about using nature's methods, like the iron fertilization, nature does that using iron dust from volcanoes and from dust storms. And so it's well tested by nature, and we don't worry about it much. So we could scale it faster if we wanted to. If we do it by 2050, or the rate of cooling of the planet will be about the same rate that the planet warmed up. And we figure that's a good starting point. And we can, once we get started on that, we can optimize it to reduce the ecosystem losses.
So our listeners become convinced we could restore the climate, and many call for pressure on Congress or the national governments. But those governments are double dealing right now. They're giving out more oil and gas infrastructure money, and the Democratic Climate Action Bill is dying in Congress as we speak. Nobody's even talking about it. So what do we do? Do we need more local action, community solar projects? What do you think?
I like that. Yes, more community action, more community solar projects. And the reason is to tell people that we're optimistic, that we actually have a meaningful goal. The climate system evolved in an unfortunate fashion. And so our climate goals now made sense in 1970, which is now 52 years ago. In 1970, at the time, around the time of the first oil crisis, all we needed to do was stop burning fossil fuels, and we would have stayed well below 350 parts per million, and we would not be having this conversation. No matter what your political opinions are, we didn't do that. And so we're now in a place where reducing emissions is archaic. It's the wrong goal. Our goal now needs to be to restore the climate for future generations. That has to start with communities. We developed an idea today of Mothers for Future Generations. You know, if some listener wants to help us start that, that would be great. Because corporations don't have a constituency of future generations. They're not buyers. And the government, the constituency of the government is voters and taxpayers and donors. And, you know, our grandchildren who are either young or have not yet been born, they're not constituents. So they can't influence and they can't stand for any investment from the government for them. However, our communities can do that.
Climate restoration, the only future that will sustain the human race. That is the big job tackled in Peter Fiakowski's new book just out. And you can find out more at peterfiakowski.com. And the Foundation for Climate Restoration at f4cr.org, f4cr.org. You will find those links and more in my own show blog published at ecoshock.org. Peter, thank you for your time and for this vision.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for EcoShock. It's great to have a platform to transmit these ideas.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.